Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
...2022 was a rough year in the West. The region was several years into a mega drought. So many of the environmental challenges were already unfolding. And then this new crisis emerged that year. The Great Salt Lake crashed, reached its lowest point in recorded history, and scientists started talking about how long before the lake became too salty or too dry to sustain life, and how that could then set off this wave of cascading disasters, including clouds of toxic dust from the exposed lake bed. The filmmaker Abby Ellis told us it was an environmental disaster that was coming, but it hadn't happened yet. And so she was really drawn to that possibility, the idea that she could capture this moment before it struck.
My son was 2, and it was the year that the drought was really obvious. All the reservoirs were very, very low. And we had ash falling from the sky, both from the fires in Northern California and the fire in Parley's Canyon. It was really scary and bleak. And at that same time, my husband and I were kind of just looking at each other thinking, when you have a kid, you're looking at a place not just 10 years into the future or 20 years into the future, you're looking longer than that. But around that time, we started hearing about Great Salt Lake. And that seemed like the nail in the coffin for this place. Is it a place that we want to raise a young child? You know, I've showed up a lot in my work when the thing has already happened. When government has failed or systems have failed, and people are really sick, and it's almost too late to do anything about it. So this was really interesting in that we were approaching it from this point in the process where the really bad thing hadn't happened yet. But we wanted to do something different. We wanted to educate people about what's going on in hopes that there was still time to save the lake and this place. We wanted to act as a fly on the wall and follow people as they just did their everyday jobs. And their everyday jobs, you know, went from being these very mundane things to staving off disaster. You have scientists, you have people in government, and suddenly it's like, you know, they're just having a conversation in a fluorescent lit room across the table from each other, but what they're talking about is massive and affects us all. You know, films surrounding environmental crises typically are tough to digest, and I was hoping to infuse real cinema in this and intimate moments with characters that kept you along for the ride beyond just the facts and information. I was thinking about the fact that we in this place here right now have this looming crisis, and everyone has a role to play. And I'm a filmmaker. That's my role. I wanted to document what was happening, but I'm also an artist, and I wanted to do it in an interesting way that pushed the boundaries. And I think we did that. And we have to always think that our audience has the attention span and knowledge of a 12-year-old. So there were a lot of things like salinity and brine shrimp and stuff that would just kind of fall by the wayside as we were shooting. And it is an extremely complicated story, right? Like Great Salt Lake, it feels very simple in that the solution is you just need to get more water to the lake. But how you do that is very complicated.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with Abby Ellis about her documentary. It's called The Lake. It's in the U.S. documentary competition at this year's Sundance Film Festival. We'll give you details about screenings here in a moment. Ellis is a filmmaker who lives here in Utah. She's worked for the PBS program Frontline. Her work has earned her Emmy nominations and a Peabody Award. The Lake is it's a profile of three people whose professional and in some ways their personal lives are connected to the health of the Great Salt Lake. There's Ben Abbott. He's an ecosystem ecologist at Brigham Young University. There's Bonnie Baxter. She's a microbiologist, director of the Great Salt Lake Institute at Westminster University. And there's Brian Steed. He's the first Great Salt Lake commissioner. And these three are faced with this puzzle, how to work with politics and bureaucracy, how you find compromise, and how you make sure the public understands the risks without sparking hopelessness or inaction. The film follows their daily work, these meetings with officials and water users, looking at studies, making their own calculations as they try and keep the dying lake on everyone's mind.
I think the film is about what people do when their home is faced with catastrophe. And we follow three individuals who, in their own way, are trying to figure out how to save their home from disaster. And I think a question that we ask in the film just throughout the story is, what would you do and what lines would you cross and how far would you go in your own life if you were faced with this? That's what I think the film is about. The film is certainly about the fact that Great Salt Lake is drying up and it's two-thirds gone and the lake bed is full of arsenic and lead and mercury and all these horrible things that gets blown into the air. But it's mostly about the people whose fate is tied very closely to the lake's fate. And how they're just figuring it out, right? This is the very beginning.
Yeah.
And they're just figuring out their role in science and politics and all of these things.
Let's talk about those characters. As you said, three main characters. I thought of them as protagonists. Maybe that's the right word. Yeah. Let's start with Bonnie Baxter. I think listeners to the program will know Bonnie if they followed The Lake. She's a microbiologist at Westminster University, head of the Great Salt Lake Institute. And you begin with her. Tell us about the story that Bonnie Baxter plays and how important she is for the story. And just how and this seems to be the case with all of the characters, but how, aside from being deeply connected to her profession, it's also really personal.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bonnie's been studying the lake for 27 years. So in many ways, she in the film brings us to the lake and she represents the lake and she is the lake, right? She is the seer who sees what's coming before everybody else. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes we imagined her almost as this like physician tending to the lake. Yeah, Bonnie, to me, very much is the lake.
I've been studying the lake for 27 years, and it has become a piece of me. I didn't know I was going to be involved in an environmental crisis. I was just interested in the cool way that life lives in these extreme environments.
I mean, in many ways, Bonnie's been yelling about this for a really long time. And no one has been paying attention. And I think that's really interesting. And she chooses, you know, she has an arc in each character in the film has their own arc. But to her, the most important thing is that she continue to be respected and listened to as a scientist, because this has been her work for the last 27 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, scientists are at a really interesting place right now in our country. And I know she thinks about this a lot. She says in the film, you know, when the scientists of the Manhattan Project, after we dropped the bomb, they were like, well, we just worked on the science. We're separated from the outcome. And she's very adamant about how she thinks that's wrong. And she wants to educate the public because the public funds her.
Let's talk about Ben Abbott. He's a professor of ecology at Brigham Young University. Along with Bonnie, he's one of the leading scientific voices in the lake. What did you think of Ben when you first met him?
It's funny. You know, Ben and I started chatting a few years ago before he was working directly on the lake.
Yeah.
And he was just kind of helping to piece together the certain players. And he wasn't including himself in that picture. And I just kept going back to him because he has the ability to communicate in a way that many people do not. And I kept...
He has a charisma. Like, the way we describe it on the show is Ben's good tape.
Yeah, he's great tape. He's great tape.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we actually filmed for a while before he was even officially in the film.
Wow.
And then we finally went back to him and decided to include him because I think Ben, while he is a scientist, which is great because he can interpret science and communicate it at a baseline level, he's also a dad of young children, mm-hmm. and he's very clear in the film and in life that he's not bound by anyone,
yeah.
right? So he's very much, in my view, the voice of the people. He asks the questions that we have. He pushes when we would push, and he doesn't settle.
It's worse than we thought. The water level is dropping much faster than predicted by the state's model. We estimate that it's around 1.2 million acre feet a year of deficit. And there's only about 7 million acre feet left in the lake overall. And so, I mean,
wow.
It's immediate. It's like right now.
So we're talking about just a few years.
Just a few years. 80% of the decline is caused by local human water use. It is absolute insanity. The batting average is zero for these lakes. You know, there are about 120 of them worldwide.
Right.
And none of them, once they slip into structural decline, have been restored. Zero. I don't think anybody has realized how close to the edge we are.
I've been making films for a long time, and it's very rare to encounter a character, specifically somebody in the field of science, who can communicate in the way that he can.
Yeah.
What he has is very special.
He's also, this seems important to the story, a Latter-day Saint.
Yeah.
He's Mormon. And one of the things that's clear in your portrait of Ben in the film is just how much of his perspective on the world, the way he even processes science, is informed by faith. So we see him in the film as a father. We see him, you know, walking to church. We see him praying with his kids, teaching them these religious lessons. How important is that part, the faith part, not just to Ben Abbott, because that's clear, but to this film that's playing out in a place like Salt Lake?
I think it's really important. You know, I feel like today faith is only ever used as a divisive tool. And I'm not LDS, but I think that what these people, like a lot of what Ben preaches about, these are universal messages. And I think the LDS faith has had a bad rap nationally, right? I've lived around the country. I've lived around the world. You see films about polygamy or the FLDS or it's never positive. Or you have these reality shows.
Yeah, yeah.
I really thought it was important to give credence to the fact that a lot of what Mormons believe is what I believe, is what you believe. It's like we should take care of the earth that we were given. Who cares who gave it to us or what you think about that? But like we should be good stewards of the land. Faith is a big part of who Ben is, and I think it's really beautiful. And when you get into a situation where you're getting squeezed by all sides not to speak out or to maybe temper what you're saying about a certain issue, I think Ben's faith is very clarifying.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, he is accountable to no one but God.
Yeah.
And in his mind, God will judge us for how much water we used and for how we acted in this moment. And I think that's really beautiful.
Yeah.
And I think we need more people like that in the world.
Brian Steed is sort of the third main character in the film. He's the first ever Great Salt Lake Commissioner. He's the – okay, so let's see. If Bonnie's the seer, what's Brian? Like, he's the bureaucrat in some way, right? I mean, he's the – but he's such an interesting character. He's the sort of the bridge in some way. He's seen – how do you see him first?
Brian spans worlds.
Yeah.
And he does so very successfully, I think. And he is able to communicate with and be welcomed into rooms across the board, whether it's a room full of farmers or a room full of progressives or a room full of conservatives. He can speak the language of everyone, which is why he's great for this role. Brian is also extremely educated. He's many, many degrees. He's one of the most knowledgeable people I've ever met in my life. And I think he's great for this role because he also cares a lot. He also has kids.
Comes from rural Utah, comes from Logan.
Exactly. And the dust makes its way to his community. Brian cares deeply about this. And he can work with almost anyone. And I think that's really critical.
There's a moment in the film where he's in his truck or a car or something. He's out by the lake or something. I think he's having a conversation with someone. And this person is taking him through sort of how people are perceiving Brian.
When Brian was with the BLM, like, the ag community was ready to, like, put him on their shoulders and sort of parade him around in celebration.
Yeah.
When Brian took over DNR, people thought, well, that's cool. That's great for Brian. We love Brian. When Brian took the commissioner's gig, now we hate Brian.
Yeah. So I've heard the same. I know that at the Republican convention, one of the candidates from Box Elder stood up and said, you know, essentially over our dead body, are they going to take any of our water for the lake?
Great.
You know, and I think there's that sentiment out there. I'm disappointed to hear that it's become personally targeted towards me, but that's not surprising either.
That's really unfortunate. It becomes personal in that way.
Is there any way to repair that kind of thought process within those communities? Because you got a thick skin in these jobs, but at the same time, you know,
on the whole,
you'd like to be liked, you know, especially by people you've kind of bled for before, you know.
Right.
So,
would you just talk a little bit about this scene and what it reveals about the kind of conflict and dilemma that Brian Steed faces in this story?
Yeah, you know, one of the biggest hurdles is getting the agricultural community on board to lease their water. And I think that the lake has quite a bit of a communication problem. And so there have been periods of time where conspiracy theories have, you know, run rampant in certain communities. And there's a moment in the film where it feels as though the agriculture community is no longer willing to work with him. And that really bothers him.
Yeah.
Because he's been an advocate of this community previously.
And he's gone and talked to them. I mean, we see that. He goes and meets with these farmers, talks it out with them.
But what's interesting, I will tell you, is while there is a lot of this noise that sometimes comes up, when you go and meet with these people individually and they meet with Brian, they're taken away by him. And they're like, I don't want anyone else in this job. So something I learned very quickly was the way in which things change so drastically when you go sit down with people and just have a conversation, as opposed to them standing in front of a crowd getting everyone to rally around this idea that's not really real.
He's at a restaurant with this group of farmers. And they're saying the things you would expect, like they don't want to be seen as selling out, that they're perceived as the bad guy, that you guys have a choice. You can either have food or you can have the lake. Like all of these really kind of simple things. And he's working it out with them, talking it through. And he says to them, people perceive it as this problem or their problem. I want it to be our problem. What are you hearing in that exchange? His gift for speaking that language, do you think? What are you hearing in that? What do you see in that scene?
I mean, I think in that, you know, we know that agriculture uses more water than municipalities, for example. But in that moment, he's saying, I know you both use water. It's not one or the other. But we have to do this together. And he's right. I mean, there is no way that we will get through this if everyone is not on board. It can't be you're the bad guy. I'm not doing it till you act. So I think he knows how to communicate. And that's something that needed to be communicated to these guys. Mm. I mean, so many people don't know anything about what's going on with the lake. Yeah. And that's like problem number one. So oftentimes when you walk into these scenarios and you're chatting with folks, you have no idea what their knowledge level is.
Yeah. Yeah. He goes out and sees a farmer, Sam. And I really like this scene because we see, you know, Sam's out there flood irrigating his fields.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting contrast, right? I mean, we're all talking about water and then he's flood irrigating his field. And Brian comes to his house, talks to him, and one of the things that he says, and you can tell that they're having a good conversation, but Sam comes to this conclusion that, look, I'll do what I can, but in the end, as he says, God's in charge. And again, faith comes into play. What do you make of that particular scene? Because we should say Brian is also a Latter-day Saint.
Right.
And in fact, we see a lot of Brian's faith. He's preparing a lesson for church. He's you go to the airport with him when his son comes back from an LDS mission. We see his life is deeply involved in faith, but his sense of faith and the role of God is different from Sam's.
That's what I love about the way faith plays out in the film is they all practice the same religion, though with slightly different interpretations of that religion. So for Ben, for example, what you learn about him as a man of faith is that he's accountable to no one but God. With Brian, it's like, I pray, I believe in God, I think there's room for faith in this. But I have to get up and go to work every morning, and I have to do my best to get more water to the lake. God doesn't want us to just rely on him. And then you have this other category that Sam is in, where he's like, God's in charge, and God will take care of this.
And look, Spencer Cox, the governor, called for us to all pray, and we did. And look, we had that miraculous water year.
Which honestly was pretty biblical.
It was.
I get it.
Yeah.
You know? And even Ben says in the film that water year was, he thinks, an act of God.
Abby Ellis. Her documentary film is called The Lake. It's showing in the U.S. documentary competition at the Sundance Film Festival. The world premiere is today at 2:30 in Park City. Though we should tell you all the in-person screenings of the film are currently sold out, but there will be an opportunity next week to watch the film online. We have a link to that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a documentary premiering at this year's Sundance Film Festival. It's called The Lake. And it's the first feature-length film on a national stage that explores the consequences of the decline of the Great Salt Lake. The filmmaker Abby Ellis follows three people, two scientists and a political insider, who are grappling with how to communicate a slow-moving disaster that's already unfolding. They have to work out how to navigate bureaucracy and compromise, how to communicate what it means if the lake continues to shrink. Back now to our conversation with Abby Ellis. I want to ask about the images in the film. And this comes up all the time when you're talking about the lake, that weird contrast that it's dying out there. It's desiccated. But along the way, because there's so many minerals and the interaction of, you know, what liquid is out there is playing out with all the chemicals and whatever, and it's kind of beautiful. So how were you thinking about what you wanted to convey as the beauty but also the disaster of Great Salt Lake?
It was a hard decision to make because you could just make a nature film out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is so stunning.
Yeah.
The wildlife is incredible. The lake is just absolutely beautiful. The colors are out of this world. And you can go to different parts of the lake and it doesn't look like these parts are connected at all. It looks like you're at different, you know, you're in different countries basically. Mm. And I struggled with that because at first I wanted to make a film that showed how beautiful the lake is. Mm. I thought maybe an audience would relate to that and want to fight for that as a result. But then as time went on, as we learned more, as we filmed more, as the lake continued to dry up, I wanted to feature it more as the drying lake that it is, mm-hmm. right? It's two-thirds empty.
Yeah.
Every time I'm out there almost, there feels like there's a dust event. So I thought instead it would be better to feature the lake as this dying entity.
Yeah.
Right? Because it is dying, as opposed to this vibrant body of water that's so full of life.
Tell us about the music. Let me just say what I... It's haunting. It has a kind of... it brought to my mind other places, like other salt lakes in the world. Like it has a worldly sensibility to it. I don't know. What were you thinking? This is a Ukrainian artist, Natalia Tsupurik.
Yeah. We'll do it at the end.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Natalia's from Ukraine. She lives in Kyiv. And I initially talked to her about Chernobyl and that vibe of horror, because at the end of the day, stories of environmental crisis like this are stories of horror. And I found her music to be both haunting and beautiful. And I thought it was just perfect for this film. We also had an incredible sound designer, Tom Paul, who in moments where you don't hear the score, he's infused the scene with a lot of depth that I think also is horrifying. Because, you know, a lot of this is like it's dust.
Yeah.
It's hard to make dust scary.
Yeah.
But it's horrifying.
Yeah.
It's arsenic-laced dust. There's lead in it. So there were moments when, you know, you see the dust envelop the city. We really wanted to amp that up and make you feel the monster that it is.
One of the things about the film that is kind of remarkable is the access you had to these intimate conversations. And part of that is just like that's what Verite filmmakers do. They ensconce themselves and they hope that magic happens. I know that's part of it. But what was the technique and strategy that you thought about that and were – because you managed to pull off – it's like it's one thing to hear Bonnie Baxter and Ben Abbott having a conversation. They're on the same page. You know, they're thinking this in similar ways about all of this. But then it's another thing to – which you did. You were in these sometimes these budget conversations where conversations about political strategy was playing out. You were in a briefing with Governor Cox. So how did you manage all of that?
We spent a lot of time with these folks over, you know, we were with them for 2 years. Yeah. I filmed a lot of Brian Steed giving PowerPoints before I was ever able to enter those rooms.
Huh. So they just came to know who you were.
Yeah. And they're pretty good at vetting people.
Yeah.
But also what I tried to explain to them, which is true, is that, you know, what they would be worried about getting out in those conversations is like the insider baseball stuff that I don't care about. I just care about the really basic conversation that they're having. And I want the audience to feel the stress that they're under and the magnitude of these conversations. But it's like very simple stuff, you know? And so we had a deal that I would film the interviews and share with them what from the interviews I thought was interesting before we would keep going. And it was never the stuff that they cared about, right? It was the more basic stuff. So we got comfortable with each other in that regard. And I think with the governor, I knew throughout this was really important to the governor.
Yeah.
A lot of politics happens behind the scenes. A lot of it is not filmable, which was a lesson for me. So, you know, we had to figure out ways to include him and showcase what he was doing, even though, you know, over the course of the year or whatever, we weren't in all of those rooms. And the governor's office was very open and super kind in letting us do that.
But the politics does come across in the film. For example, we see the governor speaking to a group of, I think it's a group of farmers.
He's doing here. Thank you for inviting us. You all know that water is the lifeblood of our state. It's critical to everything we do, especially to our agriculture community. I'm still a proud farmer. I still grow alfalfa and I'm proud of it. We like to do what we call ceremonial bill signings. So the very first one I wanted to focus on was the work that was done on water, because I know there are a lot of people nervous out there. They keep hearing the Great Salt Lake is going to dry up in 5 years and we're all going to die from dust or whatever. Not true, by the way. And I can't wait to celebrate with all of you on the 5-year anniversary of when we were told the lake was going to dry up in 5 years. It's not going to happen.
And then we see Brian Steed in the audience sort of reacting to it. And to me, it just – that was the politics of the moment that you convey in that scene, the give and take of the story.
Right. Well, he's speaking to a group of people who are his constituents. They're the agricultural community, so it's obviously a speech more tailored to them. At the time, I think there was a lot of debate around the 5-year timeline.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting because watching that, it's not that he's saying the lake's not drying up and the dust isn't a problem. He's saying in 5 years, you're not going to be choking on dust and dying. So there's nuance in there.
Sort of.
Sort of.
But he's also very directly saying
it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is just really interesting. And again, another one of the themes that seems to me in the film, at least comes out, is what is the best method of expressing there's an emergency coming to a community?
Yeah.
Because on one hand, like this comes up in the conversation about Ben is worried that they're watering down the message.
Right.
Everyone is saying, dude, you can't just say that people are going to die of toxic dust.
Right.
You have to say there's some hope. You can't overreact. And he says in the film, like, I worry that we're watering down the message. He doesn't want to be, as he says, over careful with the language. And we see a lot of that too.
I think what he says in that scene is so interesting and important, because he says, you know, scientists have systematically underestimated the rate of change, the impact of change. And that's true. And he says, if it doesn't happen, if like the false positive or whatever is so much worse, then we should err on that side. And I think that's really interesting and important. And I really appreciate Ben pushing back, constantly pushing back on the fact that we have to be careful with our language. Because I go get my kid his haircut, and the guy cutting his hair has no idea that the Great Salt Lake is drying up. So it's like people don't know what's going on. They don't know how dangerous it is. I've been in rooms where people talked about how on a windy day you shouldn't really go outside in Salt Lake City. And it's like that is not public information. We are so behind the eight ball in communicating this that I really appreciate Ben throughout pushing back on that. And I mean we're at a point where I wish when it's windy, when there are dust storms, why aren't we getting alerts on our phone? Go inside. Wear an N95 mask. People should have the agency to save their own lives, and they don't right now because they don't know what's going on.
There's an interesting moment where Bonnie and Ben are not entirely on the same page on a particular issue. And there's this – in the effort to get some money to the lake, to get the different parties to do something, there's this question, should we list as an endangered species one of the birds out there, the mm-hmm. Wilson's phalarope, which is going to require more drastic restrictions, like maybe even sort of taking private property rights from people. And Bonnie feels conflicted about that.
What we're seeing with the phalaropes is really like what I would call a sketchy distribution. You know, usually they're clustered in this area or that area, and they're just kind of spread thin. And I've barely even seen them this year. But I really feel like I'm going to make a different decision here just because I try to, you know, keep doing science and sharing it on the inside of all these state committees I'm on.
It's interesting that there's even a conflict between these two deep advocates here.
Right. Right. And I know if you talk to Ben about the petition, his reason for signing on was strictly scientific.
Sure.
But
the question is whether it's the right strategy.
Right. Exactly. And that's something the scientists have to deal with today. Yeah. That's a little insane, frankly, you know. And I think he didn't necessarily realize at the time how polarizing that would be. But again, why should he have to think about that? The science is the science. And you should be able to, as Bonnie says in the film, sign on to a petition about your environment that you're studying or that you're living in.
Yeah.
You know, I do think it's interesting. It's important to Bonnie that she continues to be – her science continues to be taken seriously.
She wants to be in the room.
She wants to be in the room.
Yep.
But I also think there's probably – you know, Ben is a man and he's an LDS man. And – Bonnie's a woman. And I think as a woman myself, you have to navigate things a little bit differently. That's just the nature of the world.
That's Abby Ellis. Her film, The Lake, is showing in the U.S. documentary competition at the Sundance Film Festival, which opens today. All of the in-person screenings of The Lake are sold out, but there will be an opportunity next week to watch the film online. You can get more details about that on our website, RadioWest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the filmmaker Abby Ellis. We're talking about her documentary that profiles three people trying to save the Great Salt Lake. Scientists Bonnie Baxter and Ben Abbott, along with the Great Salt Lake Commissioner Brian Steed. They're testing how far to compromise, how to communicate this urgency without making people feel there's just no hope. It's called The Lake, and we'll give you details about how to see the film a little bit later in the program. There's a remarkable scene that you captured. Ben Abbott is having dinner with his family. One of his daughters doesn't want to finish her dinner. She wants to, you know, typical sort of interplay. And it's great. It seems just kind of charming and whatever. And then all of a sudden he gets a phone call. And it's a terrifying phone call.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to say something about this particular moment? Because it leads me to a question that I want to ask, and that is how Ben changes, mm-hmm. how his intensity, how his commitment intensifies. We just Tell people about this moment, if you don't mind.
Yeah. I mean, up until this point in the film, we understand that the dust storms are big. They're getting bigger and they're getting going farther. And they're hanging out in the air for longer. Yeah. Ben lives in Provo. And this is, I think, one of the first times we learn that the dust is moving beyond just Salt Lake or the Valley. It's coming to Provo. So Kevin Perry, an atmospheric scientist at the University of Utah who studies the dust, calls Ben.
Massive dust storm. And it's headed your way.
So even though the dust was moving your direction, there's nothing that we have to actually document where it's at or how long it takes to get there. But get people inside and close the windows.
That's horrifying. I mean, you know, I know that there have been moments where dust storms have been coming to Provo and those same little kids have been like, Daddy, can we go to the park? Do we have to wait for the dust to go away before we go to the park? When's the dust going to be gone? And it's like, it's horrifying, but it's what I think is even worse about that is no one else in the neighborhood knows that because no one else in the neighborhood's getting a phone call from the leading atmospheric scientist studying this.
Exactly. And one of the questions in the film is whether or not lawmakers are going to give enough money to buy monitors.
Yeah, that's a big deal. And that's something that I've felt very strongly about, that we have these dust storms. Once you're tuned in and you know what you're looking for, you can see them pretty easily when you look down towards the lake. They're pretty frequent. But what's crazy about it is we don't know anything beyond that. We don't know if the arsenic falls out before the storm moves into a community or if it goes with it. Mm. We don't know for how long it's staying in the air. We can't even answer these questions to diagnose the problem. That's not okay.
It's at this part of the film where it seems like something changes for Ben Abbott. His intensity ramps up. What's going on? What did you see with Ben Abbott at this particular moment? Because it's quite interesting.
Yeah, I think that he feels like they've been sort of following the rules and operating within the lines that the state has sort of drawn for them for so long, and nothing has gotten done. And the situation continues to devolve, and he needs to push harder. And I relate to that as a person who lives here, and I appreciate that. You know, he has four little children and he's in meetings where they're talking about how bad the air is and how significant these dust events are. Utah is very interesting in that people live – not everybody lives in the same place. People live hours away and they commute in or whatever at the legislature all over the place.
Yep.
And I think that can make this very tricky because – you know, for example, the inversion, you don't see it unless you're coming down into the valley. Mm. Even if you're here, you don't really see it on some days. And I think, Ben, I think I was also feeling a little stir crazy that you're in these meetings, you have this information, and then you're kind of supposed to just go about your day like everything's fine. On a windy day, you're just supposed to like go to the park and you have no idea if there's arsenic in the air. I did a big investigation into the Flint water crisis a few years back, and that was like international news. And almost everyone around the world now knows that it's bad to have lead in your water. And if you told them you have lead in your water, they'd probably panic and get bottled water for their kids or something. But there might be lead in the air, and we haven't yet connected that. And so I think as a parent, you know, Ben is just responding very logically. But we have this question these days, like, what is the role of a scientist? And I think he really pushes back against what at least conservatives think that needs to be in an elegant way.
Hmm. I want to ask about something that is revealed about Bonnie Baxter. And I'll be careful because I don't want to give this part of the film away. Let's say that, as she says, it's become almost more personal than it has professional. What can you just tell me about this kind of twist in the film that deepens the questions for Bonnie?
As I mentioned, Bonnie's been on the lake for 27 years working.
Yeah.
And it gets to a point over the course of our filming where she has a difficulty breathing. And a doctor can't possibly rule out the fact that she's been spending all of this time in this area in which there are these dust events. So I'll keep it vague because I don't want to give too much away. But Ben says to her, and I think in a way that's very true, that like she is the canary. And if we don't do anything, the lake will come to us in the way that it's come to her. So, but I mean, I really feel for her because personal health is very serious. And when you're hit with something so personal, it's difficult to think, do I want to spend my time continuing to fight just for people to believe that this is real? And that's kind of what I think she battles with.
Abby, what did you learn about compromise in making this film? Finding that balance between being urgent and active and also trying to make it palatable to a larger audience that isn't necessarily – did you learn things?
Yeah. I mean, I think what I learned more was just how to move forward in the world as a person as we encounter these situations. Because what was really interesting to me, I was in a lot of rooms. I was in rooms with people in government. I was in rooms with scientists, progressives, Republicans. And one thing I walked away with is like, we can do this together. I was, you know, like it was very rare to be in a room where someone was like, I don't believe that that's real. And I think we've entered this – I mean, I don't even have to say it. Everyone knows it. But everything is so divisive. Parties aren't working together. What I learned making this is that we can and we have to. And we also have to take risks. You know, I think Ben took a lot of risks. I think that they paid off. And I think listening to your gut is – and listening to your conscience and being, you know, driven by what's right – ultimately pays off.
This may not be a fair question, but as you said, you were in a lot of rooms, with a lot of discussions, talking about budget. Will there be enough money? Will there be political will? Will lawmakers do something about it? Will citizens, everyday citizens, respond? Did you come away from that thinking, well, being optimistic about the prospects of saving that lake or not?
It was a bit of a roller coaster throughout filming, how I felt about that. But my takeaway is one of optimism. I have a lot of faith in the people on the front lines who are fighting this, that they're not going to give up and that they know how bad it is. It's just a matter of getting across the finish line. But I think we're much closer today than we were even 2 years ago when I started filming this. What concerns me the most is the communication problem that the lake has and how few people really understand what's going on. Because I think the more people that understand what's going on pressure the legislature, which helps these people on the front lines like do their job better. If the public is upset about something, that's very helpful. So there's a long way to go with that. But generally speaking, I feel optimistic, which I'm very relieved about.
Abby Ellis, thank you very
much.
Thank
you.
That's Abby Ellis. Her documentary film, The Lake, is part of the U.S. documentary competition at the Sundance Film Festival, which gets underway today. All of the in-person screenings of the film are sold out, but there's going to be an opportunity next week to watch the film online. You can get details on our website, RadioWest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West. You can email us at RadioWest@KUER.org. I'm afraid we have to say goodbye today to our executive producer, Carrie Watson. Carrie is a valuable colleague. She's a remarkable person. She kept us on task and organized. She helped remind us about the importance of the work we were doing. And she isn't leaving because she wanted to move on or wasn't really good at her job. Carrie is one of the casualties of public media, KUER in this case, losing federal funding. And it sucks. And we'll miss her. Aidan Oneida is our social media intern. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.